wanted to point out, outside you can pick up a copy of the periodical from the ULT in Philadelphia. On the back has the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and the very bottom there's this phrase, the true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And as we were preparing for the segment, be aware of the writings of Jacob Burma, this line stood out, and we could almost imagine him sitting at this platform, or we sitting at his platform, when he says these words. A Christian, however, has no sect. He could dwell among the sects, even appear at their services, and yet hang on to none. He has only a single knowledge, and that is that Christ is within him. He seeks only one way, which the desire always is to eagerly act and live correctly. He puts all his knowing and willing into the life of Christ. He sighs and always wishes that God's will might happen in him, and that his kingdom might be revealed in him. He kills the sins in the flesh daily and hourly. But how about that? Christian having no sect, but being at one with each and all. What a vision for us. So we're going to move now to the mysticism of the Sufis. And as previously done, we'll have a brief presentation with some time for questions and comments.
It's an odd phrase, the mysticism of the Sufis, because the Sufis are mysticism. So it's like shrimp scampi. Most people think that Sufi is a mystical or interior or esoteric branch of Islam. Well, that's a little strange, since it can be historically traced back to at least the second century before the Christian era. Now, probably it could be traced back further than that, but it hasn't been done. So it's impossible to say really when it started. It's equally impossible to say what it means. If you talk to one group, they will say Suf, S-U-F, is Arabic for wool, and that in the Islamic tradition after the death of Muhammad, the Sufis wore coarse wool garments as a protest against the others who were all in silks and satins and showing all their wealth and intellectual knowledge. So that's one definition of Sufi. But there's the Arabic word Safa, which means brothers of purity. And that defines them as well. But the real definition is a Persian word, we're not even going to try to pronounce it, that has the same definition as Sophia in the Greek, which is wisdom. So Sufi really means wisdom. But they don't use that word. A Sufi doesn't call himself a Sufi. They feel that that is really a nickname, like Quakers. The Quakers aren't Quakers. It's a nickname. And like the Quakers, the Sufis use the term friends. We friends. That's how they talk to each other. Their whole premise, their whole mystical basis is we want to encounter God or that divinity within ourselves now. Not tomorrow, not next week, now. That is our whole goal, our whole effort. So over the centuries, there have been various schools of Sufism that started up following a particular teacher who attracted a group of students. But there were no organization, no diplomas, no graduations, no rewards, just study. Study to find within yourself that inner beauty. And their ideals of this school, these schools. in the world but not of it, to be free from ambition, greed, intellectual pride, blind obedience to custom, and no awe of persons of rank. The ethics, to be humble, not assertive, natural kindness, moral sensitivity, non-judgmental, appreciation of beauty, and a wonderful, wonderful phrase, love the pitcher less and the water more. At times when you're reading Sufi works, they seem simplistic, but it's later when you're thinking about it, you realize that like a flower, it opens something in your mind and in your heart. It's very, very instructive and constructive to read the beautiful poetry and language of the Sufis. What they sought was a direct experience, not an intellectual awareness, not pile on all the knowledge, but to have a direct experience within yourself of that divine principle. Their knowledge was due to the work of the heart, not the eye, the heart. They said, the word of God, the world is God veiled. The world's objects are garments God dons to create a world. In other words, it is up to us to use the inner eye to see through the garments in the world and the garments in ourselves. Equally, they looked at the Quran, because of course Sufism today is pretty much involved with the Islamic teachings. But every verse of the Quran, they said, contains a minimum of 7 symbolic significances. There's so many of these statements you will find in Theosophy. Extinguished the sense of oneself as separate. And this is where they have a problem with some of the Muslims. Some of the Sufi ideas are pushed aside as being a little too far. The Muslims say there is no God but God. The Sufis say there is nothing but God. And that makes for a problem with them, because that implies the trees, the sky, the water, everything is God. And that is not acceptable to many of the Muslims. When we come to the historical record, and because it's Ramadan right now, we were unable to reach any mosque to get some help on pronouncing some of these words, some of these teachers. So we're not even going to try. You can look later if you like. One of them was called the Invisible Teacher of the Jewish faith. It's Khidr. And then there's the very famous Inayat Khan, who brought it to the West in 1907. But anyway, we have some readings from the 12th and the 13th century. Arabi in the 12th century wrote, "My heart has opened unto every form. It is a pasture for gazelles, a cloister for Christian monks, a temple for idols, the Kaaba of the pilgrim, the tablets of the Torah, and the book of the Quran. I practice the religion of love. In whatsoever directions its caravans advance, the religion of love shall be my religion and my faith." And then in the 13th century, the most famous today of all the Sufi poets, well, poets not fair, philosophers. He's a philosopher using poetry. Rumi. Did you know he wrote a single poem of 25,000 verses? And he wrote like 3,500 other poems. He says, "I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more I shall die as man to soar with angels blessed. In another, I looked for God. I went to a temple and I didn't find him there. Then I went to a church and I didn't find him there. Then I went to a mosque and I didn't find him there. Then finally, I looked in my heart and there he was. Again, we're back to an earlier point. The idea of God often sounds like it's a personal being, but that is not what it is meant. It is the divinity within oneself. Rumi, again, not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi, or Zen, not any religion or cultural system. I am not from the East or the West, not out of the ocean or up from the ground, not natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all. That's from his poem called One Being. We suggest go online. You will find thousands of Rumi poems there. And read one, study it, think about it, let it take fire in you. But this is our favorite line of all of Rumi's things. You'll have your own, of course. But this one is so punch you in the face. We love it. My soul is from elsewhere. I'm sure of that. And I intend to end up there. The more one reads of Sufism, the more one realizes not only is it identical to all the mysticism we've heard and tasted this morning, but that we study it daily in theosophy. The books we read, the efforts that we make, they are all to awaken the heart, not the eye. We study the intellectual just as the Sufis did, but that's for the purpose of having a foundation of realizing what is real and what isn't real, and then going within and opening up to a sense of unity with all of life and a sense of responsibility.
We only wanted to add, as the speaker said, that in the 20th, 21st century, a good deal of Sufi mysticism is still centered in the Quran and Sharia, but there is a significant effort to make Sufism universally available by minimizing its specific Islamic character. Idris Shah, the Sufi master who lived from 1924 to 1996, wrote a book, The Sufis, published in 1964, in which he stated just what we heard, that Sufism predated and transcended Islam. And then the other individual, we don't think we're pronouncing it correctly, Anayat Khan, 1882 to 1927, wrote that Sufism transcends all specific religious traditions. He was the founder of the Universal Sufism and Sufi Order International, which still is vibrant today. He said, Sufism, when stripped of ritual discipline, scripture, and religious law, becomes a variant of a universal gnosis. Getting back to that idea of the Gnostics.
And there are five Sufi orders in the United States that are from Khan's Universal Sufism. They're called Sufi Order International, the Sufi Ruhaniyat International, the Sufi Movement, the Fraternity of Light, the Sufi Way. They are all active here in the United States. And as far as the number of Sufis in the world, it's between 50 and 100 million. It is a very active, very spiritual effort.
So we invite your questions and comments on this third of our traditions in the West of mysticism. Yes?
Yeah, I used to belong to the Sufi order of the West, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan. And like we used to say, the divine in me greets the divine in you. Like you said, we're all Christ, we're all Buddha. And our symbol was a heart with wings.
Mm-hmm.
But they never wore it. Like I'm looking, I can't find one anywhere. I wear the cross, I wear the Star of David, I wear the Buddha.
We think you're looking in the wrong place. It's within the heart of the individual,
right,
who
so
feels
I keep
it.
The symbol in my heart.
Yes. And I think sometimes when we see someone smile, we see their heart. But symbols are definitely a serious part of the Sufi methodology. You should take a symbol, ponder it, carry it with you, study it, think about it, and look for things in nature. One of our favorite symbols has always been the acorn. Put an acorn in your pocket and carry it for a week and think about it. In that acorn, if no one stopped it, if there wasn't anything else in the way, that one acorn has enough oak trees in it to cover the face of the earth. Why? Because the tree that comes from that acorn has how many acorns on it? 100, let's say? All right, and those 100 grow. And they each have 100? It wouldn't even take very long. So we can learn from the things around us, the life around us. But you'll never find that symbol anywhere. It's too sacred.
Right.
Those of you familiar with the third fundamental proposition of theosophy are aware of the idea of the divine presence gradually unfolding and the intelligence unfolding in all the kingdoms. And of course, a lot of that could be expressed in very deep metaphysical ways. But listen to the beautiful poetry in which these same ideas are mentioned by Al-Harabi. God sleeps in the rock, dreams in the plant, stirs in the animal, and awakens in man. Put that on the refrigerator. Well, if there, yes.
It's like the stripped-down version of the major religion. So why did all these mystical ideas, how were they perverted? Why were they perverted? And all the ritual and the trappings and everything, I mean, why were they perverted into something else?
Well, one can never really answer that question unless they were there at the time. Was it for political purpose? Was it for financial purpose? Was it just for power and wanting to have control of the people? There was a comment made when they were challenging the idea of pre-existence at one of the ecumenical councils, and the report was, if we let people know that they would live again, they would just do whatever they wanted in their life. And this is very dangerous. Leaving out the whole idea that there is a law that protects us, that forces us to find and meet our mistakes. But they were trying to keep control of the people. And that is a sincere comment. That is one way to do it. Don't let them know too much. There's another wonderful thing that you might read, and that's HPB's translation of the Grand Inquisitor from Brothers Karamazov, is that? Yes. And it shows that same sort of, we can't let you, Jesus, go back out into the world because you'll ruin everything with all of this teaching about truth and love, and you can heal yourself. So there's fear involved. But they didn't pervert the mysteries or the mysticisms. They blocked access to them. They have not been damaged The truth is still there. We just have to find it.
Thank you.
Okay.
So we come to the point where we're leaving the historical, the background, and now we're in the 21st century. We think because we are here, we know firsthand and in talking with others that mysticism, whether we find it in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or the Eastern traditions, or even in the teachings and works of Theosophy, is very much alive and vibrant. So our last presentation this morning will be on the challenges and opportunities of Western mysticism in our modern times.
Good afternoon. I guess the next 5 minutes, that's what I'm going to address.
Ten.
Okay, thanks. Long story short, the title is Theosophic Themes in Western Mysticism. The point was made, I believe, in the talk on Sufism that there's something that is neither Eastern nor Western. And it's important to be very mindful of that, because there's only one truth, and that truth is reflected and refracted in thousands of different ways, and we heard some of the ways that that truth is reflected in Gnosticism, in the Kabbalah, in Sufism. And yet there is the whole line of traditions in the Eastern sector as well, and those that are underground that have to do with nature in her rawness. But all of these are aspects of one science, and we emphasize the word science because there does not seem to be, at least exposed to the public, the science behind mysticism. And yet the core issue with that is approaching the one divinity, which is half the task. The other half of the task is bringing that outwards and demonstrating that in everyday living and everyday life. And the source of that actually is the Great Master's Letter, if you're familiar with it, in Theosophical Articles, where all of these issues are spoken about in great detail, as well as causes. And so, jumping to the question of challenges and opportunities, in a nutshell, the challenge is the opportunity. The issue that we have in modern day science, technology, the way we live as humans, the way we believe psychologically, is that it is simply incorrect. And the most simplest reason for that, whether we're looking at the theories of science, which have clearly destroyed the old concept of materialism. We don't have to worry about that in great detail anymore. We have to worry about a different type of materialism, but it's not concrete gross matter materialism. When we're looking at medicine, as grand and as great as it is, it still poses a challenge because it presents us almost as cars that we can take apart, put together, replace the parts, and we do that well. When we look at psychology and we look at the neural correlates of consciousness, we can manipulate consciousness. We can stimulate your brain in 10, 20 different ways and make you do anything that we want to. It's possible. It's happening. It's here. So that these things in the old materialistic way are not so much the old problem. They're a new problem and a new challenge because in a great sense, they reduce us almost to nothing. As wonderful as the technology is, as wonderful as the medicine is, as wonderful as the understanding is, the challenge is how do we find our true self in the midst of everything that appears to be nothing? really. I mean, life is not considered to be very valuable anymore. We're selling body parts. We'll kill you for your body parts so that we can sell them and make money. Why? Because we know how to put them together, and we do that well. And then we'll make you happy for a little bit, and then we'll do it to somebody else to get more money. So what is the real challenge? The challenge, whether we're talking about any scientific development, whether we're talking about any degree of knowledge, even so-called spiritual knowledge can be destructive. Everything that we've heard today can be used inappropriately due to misunderstanding, not recognizing the accurate meanings and levels of these things that we're talking about. But what is the cause? What is the real challenge that needs to be corrected? And what is the great opportunity that we have? And I believe if I would simplify things very much, I would just use the words of Patanjali. Ignorance, egotism, or egoism, desire, hatred, and fear. These are the roots of every challenge in existence, as every opportunity. If we indulge the ignorance, we create the challenges, we create the problems, because we chase what is not real, and we love it. We neglect what is real. So the opportunity is to turn the world around, to realize, not recognize, not acknowledge, but to realize what is real within themselves. And as was expressed so beautifully in regards to the Sufis in one of the poems of Rumi, everything that is without. In other words, how do we live in such a way that there is no you, there is no me, there is no rock, there is no sun, there is no body? And yet, all things unfold harmoniously, proportionately, and are ever ascending to a greater degree of enlightened awareness. That's a great opportunity. How do we meet the challenge of egotism, of I-ness, which by its very nature doesn't exist, and yet we believe it does? What does the teacher say in, again, the Mahatma letters? I'm sorry, the Great Master's letter. All of us have to get rid of our own ego, the illusory apparent, not real, not true, not even existing, but since we believe it, we act on that belief and we make it so. How do we get rid of that apparent self to recognize our true self in a transcendental divine life, which is what you've been hearing about through the mystical approach? There is a scientific approach, there is a mystical approach, there is a devotional approach, there is a meditational approach. There is a constantly being present approach. And the teachers tell us that these are all simply different means for one and the same royal highway to final bliss, nirvana, or that oneness with the idea of deity. But then what do they tell us? It is not the individual and determined purpose of attaining nirvana, the culmination of all knowledge and absolute wisdom. All knowledge and absolute wisdom. And again, that's the germ that has given rise to all of the presentations and expressions of the mystical traditions, the Gnostic traditions, the spiritual traditions, the occult traditions. the culmination of all knowledge and absolute wisdom, which is, after all, only an exalted and glorious selfishness. So it's wonderful that we've been talking about it, but that itself even is not the goal. And so ignorance, egoism, because that sense of ego divides one from another. Soon as we say I, it implies not you. And everything else follows. And if it's not me, then I can decide whether I like it or not, whether I want it or not, whether I love it or hate it. And once I have it or have kept it away, I find myself in fear that all of my efforts to keep it away are not going to be sufficient, and somebody is going to bring it back. And so my fear rises, and so I have to do things to prevent that. And so all in all, these are both challenges and opportunities. How do we take all of the knowledge that we have scientifically, technologically, and use it in a way that helps to eradicate ignorance on all levels, that helps to diminish the illusionary idea that we actually exist as individual beings, separate from each other, totally unlike each other? How do we get past the idea that we actually like something and don't like it because tomorrow we don't like it and then we like what we didn't like? It's just the normal course of this crazy existence that we have been caught up in because we've chosen not to see clearly, not to live simply, not to engage in that practice of dispassion through correct understanding, and we are not willing to accept the natural consequences and implications of what all of that means. But yet, if we were, the experience of mysticism would be the easiest thing in the world. The acknowledgement of that light of deity within and without, which in some schools is the culmination, would simply be the starting point. Because then we would be able to work with nature in a way to wake up, as is the gold, all of nature to the same stature and level that exists within deity in and of itself. So in regards to particular challenges, I'll leave that up to the questions because, we can deal with the particular aspects of those if we have time.
Thank you. So we'll just take the last few minutes today in entertaining any particular questions or comments you may have. Yes?
Technologically and scientifically speaking, today's world deals with effects. But in the olden times, they were dealing with causes. So in your comment about health, for instance, in the olden days, even in my own lifetime, the local doctor could diagnose generally what you had. Today, if you go to a doctor, they have absolutely no idea what you have. Each particular specialty does a test to eliminate what you do not have so that they can figure out what you have. Yeah. So I think what is lacking in our world is integration. Mm-hmm. To look at the cause, for instance, you mentioned that the mind plays a tremendous role in sickness or health. So if we're not considering the health of the person from the mind, the soul, and the physical aspect combination, how then will we really diagnose what that person is suffering from?
Okay, so in essence, if we're not holistically considering the being, how can we actually diagnose the cause? Well, obviously, then we can't. We can treat the symptoms, and we can modify some of those, unless we're talking about things like bacteria, and then we zap out the bacteria with medications. But if the conditions still exist, the bacteria can still come back. So again, we have to work theoretically from inside out. If we eradicated the essential ignorance that we have concerning nature, concerning the life forms in nature, concerning the life essence within ourselves, and from within without, we looked at the natural flow, the natural proportion, and the harmonic balance of things in nature, we'd be able to address medicine from a very different perspective. And that would be even deeper than mind in and of itself. Because mind, as indicated in Patanjali, still, no matter how great it is and how, no matter how much it embraces the memories of past lives, which is important, it's still an instrument of the spiritual soul. So if we were able to work from within without, if we were able to see from within without, if we were able to realize that my illness is everyone's illness, i.e., again, if we were able to eradicate ignorance, egoism, what we like, what we don't like, and what we fear, the approach in this instance to medicine would be very, very different.
But before I follow, the Vedic system, the Tridosha, actually approaches that system. Mm-hmm. It existed for thousands of years, but it is not applied today. This student did some research about it, and the last input is 1950s. Mm-hmm. No mystic, mm-hmm. plus someone who's scientific, plus who's a Sanskrit scholar, has come forward translating the Vedic approach to disease.
Mm-hmm.
So we need and not an intellectual, but intellectual plus a mystic mind who has the welfare of humanity and who is willing to contribute that as a Sufi way,
okay.
without expectation anything in return. And the one that did it in the 1950s was such a one. His whole life was devoted to helping others unselfishly.
And that would be, and I can't repeat all of that, that would in fact be part of the solution, because we also have to recognize that the world determines to a great degree what they accept. And that happens according to certain cycles. So the information can be there. There may be many individuals, and if we use different terms such as synesthetics, individuals that perceive existence and nature very differently, they're out there. Many of them are doctors. But because culture and tradition is not willing to accept at this time some of the things that they do, it's just perhaps not the right cycle. A lot of the information is there. A lot of the ways of healing are there. And that can come out in time.
Why not be courageous and fearless, as you said, and come forward to all those minds who can accept and embrace it? There's a lot of us out there.
I will ask them.
Yes.
Well, everything we've heard is easier said than done. So what, how does one prepare oneself to see what you're saying when there is an antagonistic opposition somewhere within us that prevents us from grasping what you're saying?
How do we prepare ourselves when there is an antagonistic effort or energy within us that prevents that? And actually, we would probably flip what you said around. It is easier to do than to say. When we're saying, we're thinking. When we're thinking, we're separating, we're dividing, we're figuring things out, pro and con, what's up, what's down, what's right and wrong, as opposed to simply, as Patanjali would say, sitting down, engaging in life, exercising, and developing dispassion. If our goals are set, if our vision is clear, the path unfolds through effort, but it's that practice continuously and that awareness of what we are doing and how we are doing it that makes the way easy. The practice becomes easy. It's the conceptualizations about what we're doing and what is right and what is wrong that prevents. There's an interesting, again, Sufi story, and I can never get it right, but the short of it is there was the Sufi master walking on water saying a mantra. And then another pair of Sufis came by in a boat and heard him. And as he was walking on water, they stopped him and said, "But you're saying that wrong." And he said, "How should I say it?" And they told him, and he did, and he sank. So the conceptualizations, the thoughts about it, the is it right, is it wrong, is it left, is it right, what plane, this and that and the other, are trappings that truly take us away from the very simplest innate task of clearing our minds, getting rid of the passions and the desires. Because don't we do that when we're 99 anyway? Think about it. When we're 99 years old and we have lived through life, what do we want? Nothing. What do we look forward to? Nothing. If we have a spiritual anchor, that is the greatest pleasure of our life. And that is something that we can have now. And then all the rest becomes the illusionary images that they are.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, if you find yourselves having more questions, that's good. That's what we hope would happen, that we would not satisfy your hunger for these ideas, but only increase it. And so once again, we'd like to thank you all for taking some time out of your busy schedules and being with all of us today to consider and share these ideas. Our symposium is adjourned. Have a good day.